The director's report. We understand Director Anderson's feeling a bit under the weather. So Deputy Director Storr, do you want to lead off?
Good evening, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners. As the Chair stated, we're going to team up. So the Director and I will talk a little bit about the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agency meeting and some of the happenings there. We'll talk a little bit about wolves and sturgeon and outreach, some recent outreach activities. And then we're going to have our budget folks, David Giglio and Owen Rowe, come in and give you about a 15-minute brief on the governor's budget that came out mid-December. I expect with the involvement of a number of others, this will be one of the best director reports you'll have received in the past year.
Set a bar high.
So, first, at the in terms of the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, that meeting occurred in Tucson. There was a lot of focused discussion on recruitment of new hunters. There's a group called the Council to Advance Hunting and Shooting Sports, and their executive director is a guy by the name of Bill Creighton, and that group is tied pretty closely with WAFWA. So the director spent some time with Bill, and Bill told us that nearly all the states belong to this council. We are one of the few that don't hold a membership. And so the director indicated a willingness for us to join. There's no set membership fee. Some pay as little as $5,000 a year, others as much as $100,000 a year. And so we indicated we're probably more towards the five. But in interest to participate, it's a place where our new outreach staff could connect and interact with other states. And it sounds like most states are using PR dollars to cover those participation costs. So that's kind of an exciting thing. The director had a discussion about the evolving role of non-government organizations in wildlife management, and nothing really came of it in terms of a clear endpoint other than a recognition that these groups are key stakeholders and we need to build better relationships with them. Although that sentiment was not shared by all who participated in the discussion. The director had a one-on-one discussion with Dan Ash and Gary Frazier. Dan, of course, is the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Gary Frazier is their lead Endangered Species Act person. They discussed the Columbian white-tailed deer issue and the Julia Butler Hansen Wildlife Reserve. Also, some discussion around pocket gophers and wolves. There were a number of one-on-one discussions between Ron Reagan, who's the executive director for AFWA. The director had a chance to meet with his counterparts from Idaho, Virgil Moore, Roy Elliker, and then federal officials Robin Thornton and Rich Hannon on a variety of items. So all in all, an interesting meeting. Next, moving on to wolves, I wanted to let you know that we have...
Hang on. You've said too many interesting things to just keep speeding through it.
Slow me through. Slow me down.
Well, Commissioner Jennings?
Just coming back to your conversation with folks from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about endangered species. So marbled murrelets, did they come up at all?
No, didn't discuss that one.
Because it does seem like I'd like to see some discussion around what's going to happen with this results of a 30% decline in 10 years, with Washington being the center of the decline. Thank you.
Yeah, and Commissioner Jennings, I think we'd be happy. Maybe we can do a one-on-one and talk about what we are doing and what we know about the feds. And
thank you.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. The comment that not all of the agencies were favorably inclined to NGOs' involvement. Was there any one, I guess I don't see that diminishing given the nature of how society is evolving, but was there a couple themes or one or two that why they were negatively disposed about that?
I would guess that in the states that are dealing with wolves and wolf recovery, there are a variety of different experiences with different types of groups. I think the nature of our work and the diverse species and you know terrain that we cover probably has us more engaged with those groups on those issues. The number of endangered species, fish, has us pretty heavily involved, but that's just an observation of mine and some of the differences of Washington and wildlife and fisheries management versus other states.
Commissioner, hang on just a sec, Commissioner Perry. I am interested in what you said about the Julia Butler Hansen Refuge. What was the general topic taken up?
There's a discussion that's been going on between the federal agency and the wildlife area managers in the cities of Skamakawa and Kathlamet around the dike, the road right. issue, yeah. and the potential for federal funds to establish a new dike pulled back from the original, and concerns around beach access and all of those kinds of
okay.
issues.
That's been a problem for quite some time. Commissioner Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this is going to be addressed in your further comments on wolves, I'll just wait until then. But I wanted to know, early last year, there was supposed to be a determination of a status review of wolves by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the western two-thirds of Washington and Oregon, and some other areas involved. And that hasn't occurred even yet. I just wondered if there was discussion on that and what the status of that is.
We've got some news for you on that, Commissioner Perry, in just 2 minutes.
Very good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
So I'll use that as a segue then to move into wolves. We do have a series of public meetings, three to be precise, scheduled on wolf management this month. Purpose of the meetings is to update the public on wolf status in Washington and to provide an opportunity for the public to talk with our lead and other lead wolf experts in the West. Keynote speakers include Mike Jimenez, Rocky Mountain Wolf Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Wyoming. We also have Carter Niemeyer, who is a retired wolf specialist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services, and then Donnie Mortarello, our carnivore section manager. The public meetings are scheduled January 16th in Spokane, 6 to 8 p.m. The next day, January 17th, in OB2 here in Olympia from 2:30 to 5 in the afternoon. And then the following day, the 18th, in the Magnuson Parks Garden Room out on Sandpoint Way in Seattle. That's a 6 to 8 p.m. meeting. So, again, trying to gear up our outreach efforts and give people a chance to hear from national and our local experts around where we are with wolf recovery and ask questions and create some dialogue there. In response to Commissioner Perry's question in terms of the status of the federal decision on delisting, I'll turn it over to the director for that conversation.
Well, we'll see how I do here. We had at the WAFA meeting, we had an executive session with Dan Ash, the directors, and Dan Ash and some of his key staff folks, including Gary Frazier, who's their lead ESA coordinator. And the topic was solely wolves. And so I'm going to be a little bit careful and choose my words, but I don't violate any of the trust that was provided to us, given that this was in an executive session. So the listing on Canis lupus provides protection for all wolf subspecies in the United States because it covers at the moment the entire U.S. And we have the distinct population segment, DPS, that's been determined for the Northern Rocky Mountain and the Great Lakes. but the Mexican gray wolf is not Canis lupus. So if they make a determination to delist Canis lupus, then they lose the protection that they currently have for the Mexican gray wolf. So their dilemma is, we can take action to delist, but we need to replace the current protection provided for the Mexican gray wolf with something else. They have a pilot project area defined that is includes portions of New Mexico, Arizona, I think the southern part of Utah and Colorado. And it's, and I'm not as familiar as I should be with Section 10J of the Endangered Species Act, but this pilot project area falls under the provisions of Section 10J. And so the thought is that they would delist Canis lupus, leaving the area in which management would be done from a federal perspective to the two DPSs, Great Lakes and Northern Rocky Mountain, and the rest of the geographic area of the country would no longer be listed. Wolves would no longer be listed. So their thinking is that they would set up this area under 10J of the Endangered Species Act for a pilot area for reintroduction of Mexican gray wolves. So the potential action would address the issue in a positive way that we have in other states like Oregon. But you might imagine that states of Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico are not real excited about this approach. I think if U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service were to agree that if they found a Mexican gray wolf outside the boundary of the 10J area, that they would trap it and put it back into that area, I think those states would be much more comfortable than just allowing them to disperse and then potentially expand the area of protection under the listing of that species, of subspecies of gray wolves. So we had Arizona and New Mexico, are real active in WAFWA, as is Colorado, their directors express some concern about the approach. But that is the approach that I believe they intend to take. It was clear to me, not in that session, but in a subsequent one-on-one that I had with Gary and Dan, that the draft rule is written, it's ready to go. And while I can't say with certainty, I left with the strong impression that we will likely see a proposed rule sometime in the next 30 to 45 days that would be proposing that approach, that Canis lupus be delisted, that that subspecies have these two DPSs, and that there be a separate and a replacement protective mechanism put in place for Mexican gray wolves. So, I know every time we come, I think this time last year, we were thinking that this was going to happen in September. September came and went. And the next was, well, we want to wait until after the election. I don't know that they said that explicitly, but that this is one of the highest things on their priority list of to be addressed. They recognize that the current situation where the species is listed throughout the country is incorrect, is inappropriate, and needs to be corrected. So that is the update on that piece.
Any questions? Commissioner Kinney?
Madam Chair, so I just assume with that the Pacific DPS would be all part of the delisting of the lower 48. So they wouldn't create a separate.
No, the things that would remain for wolf protection would be the two DPSs that is as they are now defined, which we know where the border is in Washington, the Highway 97 and 395. And the rest of the area in Washington, so the area west of there, would not be subject to any federal, wolves would not be subject to any federal listing in that area, nor would they be in Oregon, nor would they be in the California and so forth.
Did you get any read on the outlook for funding assistance for wolf management in our state?
We did get, I got a word from Ken Berg here about, I want to say it was 3 weeks ago, that we were going to get some funding this year again, but it would be a little less than what we got last year. I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head. But, and we're continuing to ask them to look in other places for funding assistance for us. But I don't expect any new funding to come from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to help assist us in this next calendar year.
Are there conditions placed on that, restrictions on that, the use of those funds?
I don't recall. I think we're looking at using the money to help monitor the status of the population is what we've been using those funds for. I wouldn't expect that we would probably change that. I don't recall that there's any specific restrictions other than they be used for, I think if you moved away from using them for some sort of a conservation, that there was a conservation linkage with the use of those funds in gray wolves, I think that would probably be problematic. But we have lots of opportunities and not lots of linkages relative to the work we do that is consistent with that.
Okay, thank you.
And then just the last little piece on, so the issue with the Columbian whitetail deer and the reserve and the Julia Butler Hansen Reserve, as Joe said, was we have a failure of a dike that will inundate the reserve and put the animals that are in that, I'm sure many of you have seen it, but it's a fenced area that the animals can't get out of, theoretically, and that they're going to be put at considerable risk if the dike fails. So they're talking about moving them to Ridgefield and the Ridgefield Wildlife Reserve or wildlife area, which, as I understand it, there is some provision for a deer hunting in that area for black-tailed deer. And so we've expressed a real concern about all the work that's been done to establish the current reserve and the protections to just take these animals and put them in a place where there's hunting that would seem to put them at a greater risk of being shot than certainly where they are now, that we've been encouraging U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to look at, as Joe said, to reestablish, rebuild the dike. If it has to be in a different place, so be it. and rather than walk away from that. And one of the, I mean, this isn't, I'm not trying to be negative against the region or anything, but so I talked to Dan about this specifically in a one-on-one on, I think it was Friday night, and lo and behold, we have a conference call at noon today with the region and Oregon, with Roy Elliker and myself and staff that know more about it than we do to talk about the issue. So it does help to talk to the leadership to get some attention to matter. So at least it does in that organization. And then I don't have any definitive news to report on the sturgeon front. I did walk through the data with Roy at the WAFWA meeting, looking at the, there was scenarios that we had from what the quota was in 2012 to a 2013 without a buffer, which, excuse me, and a 2013 with a 10, 15, 20, and 25% buffer. We have a, and looking at the, at what the impacts, in particularly I was looking at the sport quota and what the impact would be. So that's the, and also then looking at the, what the corresponding harvest rate would be, because obviously in each one of those instances it would drop. So we haven't, sorry, we haven't concluded our conversations yet. We're going to continue them next week up at the Pacific Salmon Commission meeting. I'm optimistic that we will be able to have a buffer in place that's greater than 10%. But how much greater than 10%, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess at this moment. But I'm hoping to have this just wrapped up with him by the end of next week.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the current conservation buffer we have on there? Is it currently 10%? I thought it was 15 or...
It's 10%. We had agreed to deviate from the accord, and which takes it to 16%, and add a 10% buffer to that for 2013.
Okay.
I'm sorry, if I could just...
Commissioner Jennings?
I guess the concerns around sturgeon were a significant concern, I think, for the, my understanding from the members of our side of the Columbia Working Group. I thought we had, I had, from what we heard before, there was some agreement that there was wanting to move forward to hear that, in fact, they might not be willing to increase the percent conservation buffer from the current one, even though we've raised it. I guess I'm just not thrilled with that as a response. And I understand that we've delegated to you and you're negotiating with them. Just from a comment perspective, I would hope to see some sort of movement in that direction to recognize, to even if they don't embrace our concerns, to at least recognize them and give us some additional comfort while we move forward and wait for new data. So again, negotiations go both ways. We're working with them on the whole Columbia River issue. And I do sort of expect to see movement in both directions about addressing both states' concerns.
Well said.
So just
Dr. Anderson.
Maybe I think I said this. I mean, I believe that we will get a, we will have a greater conservation buffer than 10%.
Great.
How much greater? I'm not sure yet, but.
Yep.
We will, we're going to be successful, I will be successful in negotiating a greater percentage than 10%. I'm confident of that.
Thank you, because that's not what I thought I heard you say earlier. So
I'm sorry.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think at our last meeting, the full commission, I heard from everyone that we all agree.
Yes.
So the director's gotten very clear guidance from us.
I've made it very clear to Director Elicker of our perspective and our disappointment with their commission's action, and that we believe there's a strong case to be made that we take a more precautionary approach, and that, frankly, we're expecting them to help us in that regard.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Madam Chair, I have two more topics, community outreach and budget. On the outreach front, as you remember, I'm sure the need to build more connections with local governments, with local communities, was among our high priorities in our strategic plan for this year. So we're moving forward along those lines. We recently hired a new staff person by the name of Jason Wettstein as our department's community outreach coordinator. He starts February 1st and reports to Bruce Botka. Jason has about 15 years experience in marketing, community outreach, and media relations. For the past 5.5 years, he's been the media and community relations manager for the Evergreen State College. He's also served 3.5 years as the marketing and public relations manager for the Alaska Sea Life Center. So we're very excited to have Jason on board. He's a guy with a lot of smarts and a lot of energy, and I think you'll like him. In terms of additional outreach, we are working to have our program and regional staff at sports shows. We'll have staff from public affairs, enforcement, and wildlife. They're working now to develop displays and consistent messages and information for several sports shows around the state this winter. So we plan on having these displays and staff at the Tri-City Sportsman Show in Pasco, January 18th through the 20th. The Washington Sportsman Show in Puyallup, January 23rd to 27th. The Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show in Portland, February 6th through 10. The Central Washington Sportsman Show in Yakima, February 15 to 17. Wenatchee Valley Sportsman Show, February 22nd to 24th. The Bighorn Adventure Show in Spokane, March 21st to the 24th. We'll also be sharing space with the state's Parks and Recreation Commission at the Seattle Boat Show, which is scheduled for January 25th through February 3rd. So at each of these shows, we'll be talking about how all of our programs contribute to providing top quality recreational opportunities for people who hunt and fish, as well as for the non-consumptive users of our lands and boat ramps, et cetera, such as hikers, boaters, and wildlife watchers. So quite a bit of work there, but we sort of scaled back a couple of years ago with the budget impacts, and we're trying to pick that back up now a little bit in terms of the intensity. Finally, on the outreach front, we took a little bit of a break during the holiday shopping season in terms of working with Cabela's, but we've resumed our collaboration with them to produce weekly radio ads about outdoor recreation opportunities in the Yakima, Ellensburg, and Tri-Cities areas. We're increasing our community outreach capacity that way, and it'll help us maintain and expand partnerships like this one across the state. So I don't know if you saw them or heard about it, but we've had our staff there working with a representative of Cabela's and getting these little spots on TV, and it's good for Cabela's and good for us. So that's kind of exciting, and we're looking at other potential opportunities along those lines with other organizations.
Commissioner Smith?
That's good, Joe. I think I raised this a couple meetings ago, but what about working, I mean, with Cabela's and other regional areas, because they just opened the new store up north, and, you know, that might be an opportunity. Nothing breeds success more than, you know, imitation of that. So
yeah,
are they receptive?
Commissioner Smith, I believe they are. Yeah, we're hoping that, you know, this is a success, and then we can expand from there. Okay, with that, then I'll turn it over to David Giglio and Owen Rowe. David is our Assistant Director for Technology and Financial Management, and Owen is our Agency Budget Officer. And they're going to give you just a quick rundown on the governor's budget that came out in mid-December. Remember, this budget is the first of, well, in this case, probably four we're going to see before the session's over. The current governor, the new governor, and then the House and Senate. So I'll take it away.
Thank you, Joe. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Before we get started, and no one makes this presentation on our budget, I'd just like to commend the work that the agency and Owen in particular have done over the last year. We're still in difficult budget circumstances. We're having a very slow and steady economic recovery with none of the vibrancy we'd like to see. The context for this conversation is general fund reductions. In the meantime, Owen has lost the majority of his shop to people promoting out of the group. So he's gone from having just having two people helping him manage the agency budget process. Now we're fully staffed up back to six. But it's been a very difficult set of circumstances, not necessarily the recipe for success, the budget pressure, not having staff. However, I just want to commend the work that the whole agency has done. The information flow between programs and central budget has been phenomenal. The degree to which we can talk about outcomes, the economic impacts of the work we do, the quality of life attributes of the recreational opportunities we offer, it's really resonated. So I think you'll see that the results under these difficult circumstances are quite positive. And so once again, I just want to thank Owen for the work he's done. We've had no crisis, no drama, no delays. Everything was on time and running smoothly, even with the short staff. And also thank the budget staff and the programs for excellent work. So with that, I'll turn it over to Owen.
Thank you, David. Good morning, Commissioners, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to say that generally we have some good news to present to you today from the governor's budget, considering, as David mentioned, the current economic climate. We began, as you'll remember, this summer facing another budget deficit in the 13-15 biennium as we began to develop our budget requests. And the direction from OFM was state agencies do not ask for any general fund to backfill any of the capacity that you've lost in the past couple of biennia. We only want to see requests that you can maintain current service levels or meet emergent needs. So we worked with you and with the programs to put together a budget that met those criteria, and that's why I think that we were rather successful in the governor's budget. So I just wanted to share with you a slide you've probably seen. This is graph that the governor's budget or the governor's office has put out characterizing her solution to the general fund shortfall, as well as addressing the direction from the state Supreme Court to make some additional investments in K-12. The governor is required under the Constitution to submit a budget under current resources. Generally, those are known as Book 1 budgets. And also, most governors choose also to assume new resources, tax revenue fees, in order to put forth a budget that they feel more falls in line with their values. This is a characterization of Governor Gregoire's Book 2 budget, and I'm pleased to say that both Book 1 and Book 2 for our agency are very similar. The governor characterizes the general fund problem there at the top as a shortfall of about $975 million in the general fund state revenues. She also identifies another $275 million in critical policy initiatives and makes a payment mandated by the independent arbitration of the home care worker award, which increases pay for our home care workers. So we're looking at there at about a $1.4 billion shortfall altogether, as the governor sees it. Her solution is a combination of program cuts and revenue, as you can see from the green bar below. She makes $557 million in program cuts, savings, and new assumptions. She finds $276 million by extending the hospital safety net assessment. That's basically a tax or a fee on hospital beds. institutes a tax on soda, candy, and gum, which raises to $125 million. She suspends the cost of living increases for K-12 employees. That's the initiative 732 there, saves $360 million. There's some other suspensions, $198 million in one-time fund balance transfers. We'll see quite a bit of that used in the natural resources functional area, and some repeal of some tax exemptions. The other piece here is making basically $1 billion, which you might characterize as a down payment on McCleary, and that is how she pays for that, is an increase on the wholesale excise tax on fuel to support school buses. That's historically been a transportation budget expense, or it's been an operating budget expense, but the excise tax on fuel has been spent on the transportation budget. She extends the B&O, the current B&O tax surcharge for an additional 3.5 years, raising $535 million, and then extends the current 50-cent per gallon beer tax to pay for her K-12 investments in her budget. So let's next talk about the governor's approach to the natural resource functional area. As I mentioned earlier, quite a bit of use of fund shifts, $51 million for GFS-funded programs. The majority of those are in our larger natural resource agencies, of which we are one. Ecology had $29.2 million shifted to the state toxics control account, which is a tax revenue source from the importation of the wholesale value of hazardous substances into the state. She makes use of DNR's management accounts to free up some general resources in that agency, and then also in our agency, she finds $6.1 million in fund shifts, which I'll get into greater detail in the following slide. There were relatively few general fund state reductions in the natural resource areas. One of the larger ones was a $2.9 million reduction in watershed planning in the Department of Ecology. And the explanation there was that most of these local plans have already been, these watershed plans have been completed, and she's moving, encouraging folks to move into an implementation phase and then concentrate on values of, or on the basins with the greatest need. We received a $1.4 million reduction to our payment in lieu of taxes. That is a those are our tax payments to counties for our wildlife lands. That is tied to a policy bill that basically recalculates how those that tax liability is calculated. It's basically goes back to 2009 and resets our payments to counties at $1 per acre, adjusted by 1% each year thereafter. She also continues a $300,000 reduction that we are currently managing in the current biennium for a winter elk feeding, and I think our wildlife program's done a nice job of working with other user groups to help support some level of elk feeding since we've lost funding in the current biennium. It's probably worth noting that Parks did receive some almost $18 million or of over $18 million of general fund state support. It shouldn't come as any surprise that Discover Pass revenue has been about a half of what it was originally projected, so this basically kind of leaves them at status quo. As in the 2012 supplemental, we received some ongoing fund shifts in the department. These are permanent fund shifts away from general fund state funded activities to dedicated accounts, so there's going to be no loss in our ability to provide services. It's just the use of another color of money. The ongoing fund shifts total almost $800,000 a biennium. She makes use of the Aquatic Lands Enhancement Account, which is an account that DNR manages. Revenue comes from marina leases, and the lease of our state aquatic lands. Gooey duck auctions are also a large piece of this revenue. And she uses that to support our aquatic invasive species program, as well as our ballast water programs, and also our commercial shellfish management program. State toxics control account, as I mentioned earlier, is tax revenue that comes in is based on the wholesale value of hazardous substances as they enter the state. The majority of those revenues come from petroleum products. She shifts up our Puget Sound toxic sampling program. That's a program within the fish program that tests bottom fish and other creatures to determine the type of bioaccumulation of toxins are in the environment in Puget Sound. Water quality lab is shifted to state toxics, as well as our hatchery national pollution discharge elimination permit work, and also a lot of our growth management and shoreline management work in our habitat program. The governor also makes some one-time fund shifts in our agency. These total $5.3 million. The ALEA account will support about 49% of the general fund portion of our HBA program, our hydraulic project program, which basically is our single permit to protect aquatic life from construction and work in and around our marine areas. As well as basically a repeat of a shift of hatchery expenditures to ALEA that was also undertaken in the 2012 supplemental budget. The total general fund cut to the department was $7.8 million. Total fund shifts of that amount are $6.1 million. So the net GFS cut is $1.7 million. And that's composed of that 1.4 reduction I talked to you earlier about to PILT. And I anticipate if that bill does not pass the legislature, we will not take that cut, as well as a continuation of the winter elk feeding reduction that we're currently managing in this biennium. Governor's maintenance level. Maintenance level is the portion of the budget that allows us to maintain current service levels. Most of our maintenance level...
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Jennings.
Sorry, Reverend. So what you just said was... Are we looking at this page with the 1.7 million? That if, in fact, the PILT policy bill doesn't pass, we probably won't be facing that 1.7, or at least not 1.4 of that 1.7. So, in fact, functionally, we're looking at less than a $300,000 impact to our general fund state?
Functionally, yes. You know, generally, when a policy bill does not pass the legislature, usually the cut accompanies the policy bill. So if you can't pass the policy, then the agency generally does not take the cut.
I can see, with that being the situation, why you're giving us such a rosy approach of a rosy answer of what we got back from the governor. That's a pretty nice minor hit relative to what it could have been.
It was a good outcome, especially in some of the reductions that we've seen in previous periods. Yes, I agree. Our maintenance level requests were almost all funded. We got increases for fish food, fuel rate adjustment for the enforcement program. We did not request a fuel rate increase for the rest of the program because, as you may remember, our motor pool has been shifted over to the Department of Enterprise Services. We no longer manage that, so we'll be working with them in future periods. Lease rate adjustments, many of our leases are increasing. We've had quite a growth in technology cost increases that we are unable to control without reducing our level of IT service. We were funded by the governor for those. Wildfire season costs were funded based upon a 10-year average, and they were also provisoed in our budget as we had hoped. We've got funding for both fiscal years. We did get funding for PILT in maintenance level because we are required to request those dollars because under current law, that is a mandate to us. So we requested $1.4 million increase, of which the governor then removed it in policy level under the bill that she's going to put forth this session. Youth education, there's a donation that is collected at the time of, a person purchases fishing licenses, and we've got some additional wildlife authority to be able to spend those donations. As you remember, the last session's budget directed us to put up for sale or surplus three of our buildings in downtown Olympia, which set off a series of moves so that we can get our camp program out of the engineering building, our real estate program, move our fiscal office to the NRB to get some adjacencies with our contract as well as our budget staff. So we did get funding for our camp move. Only wildlife state there. We did ask for general fund state and wildlife state for all of our moves. This was the only move that was funded in wildlife state only. Our wildlife program came forth with a request to spend some program income. Occasionally, there are some revenue that's generated through the sale of timber or some gravel sales. We got authority for that. And then we also got support for our new wild system, our new point of sale licensing system. What wasn't funded was we had a package. Excuse me.
Sorry, thank you, Madam Chair. On the wildlife field season costs, the Wildlife Committee had heard that we had some past costs that hadn't been covered, plus the new costs that from the fire season. What fire season? I mean, how big a dollar figure is that? Is that covering our outstanding costs for dealing with fire, or is that a partial payment of what we think our cost is?
Yeah, well, what I'm presenting to you right now is for 13-15 biennial budget, and when we get to the 2013 supplemental, you'll see that our fire costs, and as you will remember, we had a tremendously bad fire year this year, and we did get fully funded for that in the supplemental budget. We had a mass marking inflationary costs were not funded. We had a package to replace several of our trailers that are 20 years old.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under not funded, what amount of money are we talking about? Under the mass marking inflationary cost.
Okay, that was a package where under current law, we are required to clip the adipose fins of all hatchery-raised Chinook and Coho. We received funding from the legislature about 20 years ago. We haven't had any enhancements since then. We've basically been managing within available resources. The program also needs to replace some of their trailers, which we did get authority in the capital budget to replace those trailers, but we did not get the inflationary costs support in the governor's budget. It's about a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Thank you.
Governor's policy level. This is where new initiatives are funded. Most of our policy requests were also funded. Again, wildlife area program income was funded, a new wild system. Point Whitney staff relocation. This is something that we've asked for 2 years in a row, I believe. We got funding for that in the governor's budget this year. That's a hatchery out in the Mid-Hood Canal where we've got several staff. Not a good location for folks. We lose power out there occasionally, as well as it's a long drive to most of where our field staff are working. So we're looking to relocate them closer to where their duty areas are. We did get funding for a reduce deer and elk property damage. These are some staff to help private landowners discourage deer and elk from being on their property. This has historically been an impact to our enforcement program. We did not get as much as we requested. We requested about $700,000. The revenue comes from increasing the availability of multi-season permits for our deer and elk hunters. The governor's budget takes that additional $300,000 and puts it towards wolf population management, which we requested general fund state and did not get it. We did get funding from the multi-season permit revenue, however, and that request was intended to bring us more in line with what other states are spending on wolf management, because we tend to be a little bit on the lower tier there compared to Oregon and Idaho and some of the other states that are currently managing wolves along with us. We also got support for one of our legislative packages, which allows us to collect fees for hunter education and support that program. What wasn't? Excuse me.
Vancouver office.
Vancouver office move was funded in the governor's book two budget. All of the moves we requested were funded. Vancouver regional office was funded. We've been looking for that, I believe, for the past two go-arounds as well, and we got support for that this year, working closely with OFM facilities. And what wasn't funded, we had a request to spend some additional OLEA dollars to fund three additional enforcement officers to support and protect our gooey duck tracks. We've had some significant poaching and some black market activity because of the value of those clams has gone up substantially over the past few years. And then we had a $1.6 million legislative request to support our citizen science initiative, which was to be funded through an increase in personalized license plate fees. Back to our supplemental. The odd year supplementals are basically one time in nature. They are intended only for emergency or emergent issues.
On the citizen science for $1.6 million, you said we had hoped to be able to, I'm paraphrasing, but were we hoping to get authority to spend from the personalized license plate account? Because there is money there, we can't spend it, or?
No, there was a legislative bill. It was part of our legislative package to the governor that would have increased personalized license plate fees, and that was not.
Oh, it would have increased it, and then that increase would have, okay.
Right. We don't have sufficient fund balance in that account to support a new citizen science initiative. The 2013 supplemental is basically wrapping up the remainder of our current biennium, and these odd year supplementals are reserved for emergent issues and emergencies. Wildfire suppression costs were fully funded at $2.2 million. We also received $2.6 million in the capital budget. We lost quite a bit of elk and deer fencing in our wildlife areas. We received some additional support for wolf management, $248,000, a general fund state. That is not restricted, but it is one time in nature. It is to meet the challenges of our management of the wedge pack, as well as just the challenges in general of managing wolves in the state. We did also, you'll see some overlap here between the 2013 supplemental and what I'd originally gone through with the 13-15 budget, because again, these are one time in nature, and if we're going to have any of these requests carry forward, then we need to request them in both the biennial and the supplemental budget. So again, we got our technology cost increases funded, fish food, our youth education, our ability to spend those donations from our licensees. And then our moves, the fiscal move. Our fiscal staff are currently in an off-site office a few blocks from here. The plan is to move them to this building. And then also we were able to get some funding for a math error that I uncovered in one of our reductions to our administration or our support program costs. Discover Pass revenue has been about half of what was originally projected. We were over-appropriated there by $5.7 million, so the governor just makes a basically accounting correction so that our budget doesn't look larger than it is. We're not losing any capacity. It's just not there. So, in summary, we were spared programmatic reductions in both versions of the governor's budget. It was a very good outcome. I hope to hold the line there as best possible in a, what looks to be a very difficult legislative session coming up. So I'm urging you to be cautiously optimistic. Governor Gregoire's budget solution relies on a substantial amount of new tax revenue. Her Book One budget, where she's unable to assume new revenue, makes substantial reductions to human services and higher education. And I have a question here. Will the current political climate support any revenue increases? Latest Tim Iman initiative, Initiative 1185, which requires a supermajority in both houses to pass fee and tax increases, passed by the Washington electorate by about 65%. Governor-elect Inslee has, and also the new coalition majority in the Senate, have both been reticent to talk about any tax increases. So that concludes my remarks.
Very, very nice presentation.
Thank you.
Real clear, crisp, got us right through the salient points. Thanks. Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yes, nice job. I did get a little confused or lost track of what is the... It seems like we're shifting some monies out, paying for some things out of the wildlife account that we weren't before. And how much would that be?
Oh, that was one of the moves. Okay. When we took a look at that, putting together our move requests, we wanted to mirror how we pay our staff. And our capital budget staff, we pay, are primarily paid through general obligation bonds, the origin of which is debt service payments from the general fund state. So we estimated that about 80% of our capital budget staff should be, that move should be funded by the state general fund. That move in the governor's budget was only funded by the state wildlife account, which I assume they assume that we would use the proceeds from the sale of the buildings, which I think are projected to be about $2.4 million in the next biennium. The move itself is about, I think, half a million or so.
And
Your question had to do with moving funds to shift the work that we use wildlife account fee revenue to support. And I think that's something that we've seen in the past. We've been working very closely with OFM to make it clear what the appropriate uses of license fee revenue is. So we see less and less of that happening each year. So we don't see large shifts of wildlife account to backfill general fund work. It's coming from state toxics, tax on oil. It's coming from ALEA, guilty duck sale revenue. It's not coming from the wildlife account. The only instance here where we kind of feel like, we wish we'd had general fund to do that, and in this climate we understand why we didn't, it would be for help on the wolves, where they tap a restricted sub-account of a wildlife account to help with wolves for this fiscal year. And then with some of the moves, as Owen was talking about. But generally, we've tried to make it really clear what those fee revenues are for and to focus that money for those purposes and protect it from support, you know, backfilling the general fund.
And secondly, you or maybe the director can answer as well. Is there any discussion of relief in terms of pay freezes in the budgets for salary increases for state employees?
The governor does not include any reduction, as we see in the current period, to state employee salaries. However, I imagine as the legislature enters into the next session, pretty much everything will be on the table because they're facing a rather significant shortfall.
The collective bargaining agreement, however, does restore the 3% pay cut that staff have now, and if state revenue rises by $200 million, I believe, next biennium, there would be a 1% cost of living adjustment in the second fiscal year. So I think that's what the governor's negotiated with the unions. So that, I believe, is in her budget since she's negotiated that. Now, again, the legislature can choose to reject that, but again, they can't alter it. They can only thumbs up, thumbs down the governor's agreement with the unions.
Director Anderson, did you want to say something?
The other question is about the freeze on salaries that we've had in place since August of 2007. And that salary increase or freeze has been put in place in a couple of different ways, as I recall. One was I think it was an executive order of the governor and originally, and then subsequent to that, those salary freezes have been captured in the budget language. So that also is an issue that will be debated as we go through this legislative session as to whether that language will continue to be in the budget.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to take advantage of having Assistant Director Giglio here to ask a question about our replacing our Chief Information Officer that I guess he left a couple months ago, and just wanted to know what the status was for recruitment or plans or...
We went through the recruitment process, starting late last fall, as soon as we knew that Michael would be leaving us. We went through one round of interviews, made an offer, but could not land our top candidate because of pay issues and going from two incomes to one. And we're currently in the second phase of our second round of interviews. We do have a candidate that we're hoping to bring out February 1st. But it's a challenging job to fill. It's a very demanding and difficult job. And we're so close to Microsoft and the Seattle market for IT executives. It's a very challenging environment for hiring a good person.
Thank you. We can imagine. We cannot compete with the salaries at Microsoft. Pretty clear. Any other questions? I just have to say, looking in from the outside, having been on the commission for a number of years, this is more than good news. But that's where we are, that we've gotten to this point where enormous cuts. We're the what was expected. That's what we came to expect each year, more and more really bad news. And so the fact that our requests have been included in the governor's budget, I think, is good. It's good news. And it must have to do with the confidence that OFM now has in the department and the good job, the excellent job you guys are doing to carry our message. David's actually absolutely correct. This is a reflection of staff, the trust that OFM has in our staff. So you guys are doing a marvelous job, and I hope this really is a sign that we're finally getting beyond the terrible battle days. There's federal cuts ahead, and so there's a lot to still worry about. Do you have any perspective on what we'll see in the next year or two in terms of our federal support?
Well, first, Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for your compliments. I'm also very pleased with the governor's budget and how our relationship with OFM is working. You know, it's a $2 billion general fund reduction context. And in terms of lost work, it's just that $300,000 of winter elk feeding on a one-time basis that we're looking at in terms of lost capacity. Meanwhile, there's over $11 million of new general fund coming into the agency on maintenance level adjustments, helping with the moves, helping with IT costs. So it's a net gain of general fund under these circumstances. So that's a little surreal, but it's delightful. We'll savor it while we can. The legislature will probably reach a different conclusion that won't be quite as rosy. You're right, though, that the greatest risk that we face in terms of funding is our federal funding, and we really don't know what to expect out of Washington, D.C. these days. As they go into cutting discretionary spending, if they cannot make any progress on discussing military spending or entitlement spending, well, what is that, two-thirds, three-quarters of federal spending? So that means a lot of cuts will be concentrated in discretionary spending, which poses a lot of risk to this agency. So our battleground may shift. Our ability to talk about the outcomes of what we do in very practical and clear terms, that may shift from this Washington to the other Washington.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Do we have any number appraisal of what the Natural Resource Agency's percentage of the state budget has reached? Because I know it used to be in 3%.
Boy, I think entering into this fiscal crisis in 2009, I think the natural resource functional area was maybe 2% of the entire budget pie, and of the general fund portion, it was about 1.4%. I think the natural resource functional area is now below 1% general fund state.
That is astounding. But we have lots of priorities in this state, and education is one. K through 12 education in particular, so it's still a very challenging environment. And again, you're doing a marvelous job.
Thank you.
Deputy Director Storr, do you want to wrap up? Okay, great job. Thank you. Okay, we have a break scheduled. We're about 25 minutes ahead of schedule, so we are trying to get our next presenter here a little earlier. That's Joanna Ide. So you may be called back to order, but let's plan on at least 10:15 to come back. Thank you.